back to another edition of the Sports Bro Podcast. I am your host for this week, Tom Bassam. Unfortunately, my co-conspirator, co-host, co-star, maybe less of a co-star, I'm the star. George Breer is unfortunately unable to record this week. He's got a throat full of frogs. So I'm lucky enough to be joined by two esteemed members of the Sports Bro editorial team. Sports Bro technology editor, Stephen Caskell. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Tom, you're right.
I am very well. Well, doing much better than George anyway. And Sports Bro reporter, Josh Sim. Hello, Josh.
Hi, Tom.
Right, guys. Welcome to this week's show. All about NHL. Well, at least for the first part anyway. New season getting underway. I mean, it may have well got underway by the time this podcast emerges from the depths of the editing bin. But it feels to me as if the NHL is in a pretty good place going into the new season, Steve. Am I on the right tracks there?
Yeah, I think the NHL has often been considered, let's say, in fourth place out of the four major North American leagues, just MLS, challenging it for supremacy there in that big four. But it's definitely a league on the up. You know, the TV ratings have improved. There's lots of good storylines. Young players in the league, a large portion of the top scorers last year were young players. And there's a healthy mix of veterans and teams that, let's say, older audiences are going to relate to. The biggest storyline going into the season, I think most people will be watching for, is Connor Bedard, who is the number one overall pick in the draft this summer. Basically, the guy is a phenomenon at youth level, at junior level. He is only 18 years old, but he's going to be starting in the NHL. And I think the NHL are very happy that this generational talent has gone to a big market team like the Chicago Blackhawks. That is going to be massive. There's a lot of, I guess you can call it, analogies with the NBA in terms of its number one overall draft pick, Victor Wembanyama. Both look like they could dominate the league for, you know, a decade or more. I'm a supporter of the Columbus Blue Jackets, which, let's face it, is not a big media market. And even so, it's dominated by OSU football and the Cleveland and Cincinnati teams. I would have loved to have Connor Bedard at the Blue Jackets. In the end, we probably got the second best player in the draft in Adam Fantilli. But the NHL will be so happy that there's going to be national interest in Connor Bedard and there's going to be strong local interest. And I think it's definitely a league on the up.
Yeah, I think there's a big opportunity in Chicago, isn't there? There's the NFL team. I mean, the NFL team are always going to soak up a lot of interest. The Bears, though, are, again, not looking the best this season, coming off an MLB season where, like, those big teams haven't performed either. The Bulls haven't been relevant in a while. This feels like it could be a really good moment for Chicago hockey.
It's a market that we're receptive to a good Blackhawks team. Again, it's one of the traditional hockey cities in North America, one of the biggest outside of Canada as well. As you say, with some of the other teams not faring as well, particularly the Bears, which, I mean, the NFL is going to dominate any market it's in. That's just the reality of North American sports. But there's definitely a gap for another team in a big place like Chicago to come in. I think the local public are going to get behind the Blackhawks, and it's going to raise the profile of the league as a whole.
I think it's an interesting time as well for the NHL. A lot of kind of numbers have come out around big projected revenues. Maybe the cap could increase as a result of the fact that sponsorship revenues increased. Obviously, they're now deep into their TV rights deal with Warner and ESPN. Also, we've just had the Ottawa Senators, one of the smaller market teams in the league, being sold for nearly $1 billion. Like, it does feel generally like there's a fairly positive swing, but there is one kind of area of uncertainty, and it's an area of uncertainty that not just affects the NHL, but it affects the NBA. It's been impacting the MLB season too, and that of course is what's going on with the RSNs. Now, Josh, I don't know if you've been following this story too closely. I feel like there's been some interesting moves made by some of the teams in the league. Perhaps you could explain maybe a couple of them.
Yeah, so I guess for those who don't know, Diamond Sports Group, who operate a lot of the Bally Sports regional sports networks, RSNs, they have fallen into financial turmoil. And as a result, some NHL teams have opted to get out of those contracts with Diamond and have taken sort of different directions. The Vegas Golden Knights have partnered with Scripps, so all their games can be aired for free in Nevada and in the surrounding states. They've also got their own streaming platform that they've launched in partnership with Viewlift. So again, that's another way in which fans can watch the games quite easily, as well as the Arizona Coyotes, who have also signed a deal with Scripps to broadcast their games again locally and free to air, I suppose. So those two teams have sort of taken it on themselves, I guess, to find ways to distribute their games. You've also got the Pittsburgh Penguins, who have bought and rebranded an RSN operated by Warner Brothers Discovery. So that network is, I guess, a Penguins-owned network that will show all their games again to all their subscribers. So yeah, some teams have definitely made some moves in terms of changing up how, I guess, fans local to them are going to see those games.
Mm. Three similar-ish, but also different approaches. So obviously the Pittsburgh Penguins, still owned, recently acquired, I say recently, in the last couple of years, acquired by FSG, the owners of Liverpool. They've gone with the route of buying out their RSN and making that their own network, which has its own positives and negatives. And then the other two have gone with a kind of blend, which I think is probably a slightly more modern approach. That blend of free-to-air and direct-to-consumer. The Vegas Golden Knights one in particular, Steve, looks like an interesting approach considering it's a newish franchise too.
I think the NHL teams have less to lose than MLB in terms of making revenue. Of course, this is no drop in the ocean. It's, you know, in many teams' case, it's more than $10 million, which, you know, they're going to miss. But there is a big opportunity here. It is a more modern approach. And of course, the RSN deals go guaranteed money. But by going direct to consumer, by going free to air, you have an opportunity to build your fan base. And a lot of these teams, we're talking about the Chicago Blackhawks, that's a very established hockey market. In other places, hockey isn't as well established. So by going that route, you have an opportunity to engage with local fans, get more people coming to games, buying merchandise and what have you. And then also, you know, eventually that will convert to subscription revenue if that's the way you go. And it's a much more modern approach. I think if teams that have the ability to not necessarily forego that revenue, but again, ones that have less to lose, they know the writing's on the wall for this model. They're looking to find the next best thing, future-proof their business to how they distribute local rights. And again, if you're not the NFL, local rights are important, and it's where, to be honest, a lot of the value is. Again, it's, you look at the Coyotes going free-to-air, something like 81 of the 82 games a season aren't on national television. So these local rights are important. The way they use these rights, not just as a direct revenue generator, but indirect revenue generator, is important. And it just feels much more in keeping with the modern media landscape, even if it's not as immediately lucrative.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's a balance. The Sports Business Journal story on the Coyotes unpacked this quite nicely. It basically estimated that production costs for them would be around £4.1 million over the course of the season, which they'd have to pay, but they get to keep all of their advertising revenue from that. But then previously they were earning around $15 million per season from their deal with Bally Sports. So I think, to me, it seems like there's going to be a realignment, perhaps, of like what those local rights are worth. And maybe overall we end up with something in value terms is worth a bit smaller, but might serve the teams better in terms of knowing who their fans are, building those customer relationships, as you said, Steve. It's I think it's one of those stories I think is going to be rumbling on throughout really this entire cycle.
I don't mean to get too bogged down in RSN politics, but NHL is kind of in a unique place because it doesn't have a direct consumer platform anymore. It's basically sold that to ESPN, which basically broadcasts all of the out of market games. And, you know, a bit like Sunday Ticket for NHL, it's now part of the ESPN Plus platform. So the teams are going to have to do a bit more, unless NHL suddenly decides it's going to create another new central product for local games, which seems unlikely, although it could get rolled into ESPN Plus. So we could see something very different for the NHL than what we might see with the NBA or with MLB.
Yeah, I guess as well, it's a good point to say, we're talking about how revenues might decrease, but also if the kind of the trends continue, which was the increase in viewers for nationally televised games on ABC and ESPN last year, it was up 6%, I think. That can only be a good thing for the NHL generally in terms of growing that whole pie. Just moving on past media, and I think sometimes we can get bogged down a little bit in media. I think the sort of next most interesting thing to talk about is perhaps where the NHL fan bases are going and why that's of value, right? So we've seen a couple of teams sold in the last couple of years. Now, according to some data, and this is all available in Sports Pro's recently updated NHL commercial guide, there were some interesting findings, I thought, around the average NHL fan. Josh, perhaps if you could take us through that a little bit.
Yeah, so the research that is within the commercial guide seems to indicate that NHL fans have a higher willingness to pay to watch their team, I guess, than the typical sports fan. Ampere, who work with us to sort of help produce the commercial guides, we found collectively that the average amount that NHL fans would be willing to pay to watch sports is more than double than the typical US sports fan. And it's interesting because you know, Steve mentions the importance of local media rights and the fact that a lot of these teams, majority of their games aren't shown on national TV. And so they are willing to sort of pay Diamond and whoever it is locally that's showing the games. It's interesting to just see that it tends to be a fan base that's slightly older and more traditional in terms of their sort of TV watching habits. And so, yeah, it's interesting that I guess the league is finding success with its sort of media rights deals on traditional sort of channel linear platforms like ESPN and TNT. And it'll be interesting, to, I guess, to sort of see if that trend continues or whether the NHL, we've seen them experiment a bit with certain broadcasts, like the one they did with Big City Greens to go for a younger audience. But it'll be interesting to see if they sort of double down on those efforts or not.
Mm, the willingness to pay thing, I think, really speaks to what Steve was saying earlier about the shift in emphasis for local media and the fact that there's an opportunity for these teams to take back those rights and perhaps monetize a fan base that is willing to pay, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you take those rights and you add additional services on top of it as well, that's an opportunity. Again, it's a bit like soccer in the US as well. A lot of soccer fans have traditionally been willing to pay because it wasn't covered by mainstream outlets. Yes, I mean, this is a great TV deal for the NHL in terms of the exposure it gives it on, you know, two of the biggest cable platforms around. That's inevitably going to increase audience just because it's more available. The NHL was on ESPN a while ago. It then moved to something called Versus for a while, which was taken over by NBC. But that's not going to have the same platform as ESPN. You're on SportsCenter and what have you. And so that makes it attractive to pay TV operators in terms of how much additional revenue they can get from the rights.
And there's a new avenue for fans in the US to watch the NHL this season with the addition of the BR Sports add-on to Max. I believe that increases the volume of games available to people who perhaps are not even your traditional linear TV subscribers.
Yep. So Max, which is the new name for HBO Max.
Imaginative title, that one. I mean, well done, guys.
That would have been a fantastic marketing meeting to be part of, very early lunch. But yes, it includes Discovery Plus and it's, you know, the all-in-one streaming platform. To this point, it's not really had sport on it. The only sport has been US national team soccer games. But there's going to be an add-on launched in time for Major League Baseball's playoffs. And for a while, it's going to be free. They're going to start charging early next year to coincide with March Madness, testing out the theory that major events can shift subscriptions. And that's going to include TNT's NHL coverage, but also NBA and et cetera. It's going to be an add-on. And again, if you're a hockey fan, you're willing to pay extra, you're going to pay, you know, in theory, pay for the add-on. And Max, one of the reasons Max hasn't included sport in its stream platform is because it feels like it should be a premium product, that it shouldn't be devalued by being part of a wider content offering, something I guess like Peacock is doing. So if you've got a fan base that's willing to pay extra and you're looking to drive subscriptions to a more premium service, then that fits in with that strategy.
No, for sure. Yeah, and as I said previously, if you want to check out any of this kind of data, it's all in our updated NHL commercial guide. It's available on the.com. You'll also be seeing it sprayed around across our newsletter outlets and socials and all this kind of stuff. So well worth checking out there. Fully deep dives into everything and is available for SportsPro Plus members. Part two of this week's podcast, or the next section of this week's podcast, rather than a shiny bells and whistles part two. Now, this was a bizarre announcement that came through last week. Usually, the World Cup, the hosts for the World Cup is announced with great fanfare. There's press conferences. There's a FIFA president talking about growing the game. There's stakeholders from all over the world. Instead, what we got was a Twitter post or an X post with a picture of six flags, the World Cup in the middle, and then press release, which took quite a lot of time to digest in terms of figuring out actually who was hosting the games. And what we've got now instead is a World Cup in 2030, which is being hosted across six countries in three continents. Does anyone want to explain to me how we've got here and what on earth is going on? Josh?
I can give it a go. So 2030, I guess going a little bit back, we knew that there were multiple suitors for the 2030 World Cup. We had a bid from Spain, Portugal, and Morocco. It used to include Ukraine, and then Morocco subbed in for Ukraine. We also had a bid from South America, four South American nations, Argentina, Uruguay, Colombia amongst them. And it appears as though FIFA wanted, I mean, because I guess you had Europe and Africa behind the Spain, Portugal, Morocco bid, that seemed to be the more popular bid. But it looks as though FIFA have decided to give a game each to those South American nations that failed in their own bid. So what's going to happen is that you're going to have a couple of games at the start of the tournament in South America, I guess, going on alongside the rest of the tournament in Europe and Morocco. And then I guess those teams would fly then out to Spain, Portugal, and Morocco, from my understanding, which isn't great for FIFA's environmental footprint. I know they say they want to mitigate it, but...
Oh, don't worry. This will be the most sustainable tournament in history. Absolutely no doubt about it. Yeah, I think you've pretty much got it there, Josh. The reasoning behind the South American inclusion is that it's 100 years since the first World Cup in Uruguay. One of the games will be held at the Centenary Stadium in Montevideo. And this is all kind of part of the pageantry of the World Cup, but it's ludicrous. Like, they almost snuck out the announcement for this tournament, which basically tells you how they kind of think about it. And they might hide behind the fact that this is like a kind of preferred bid or whatever, but this is done. We are going to have a absurdly bloated tournament played across thousands of miles for the benefit of not the fans, that's for certain, Steve.
Yeah, the FIFA decided they liked the look of the Tour de France prologue and created a little opening ceremony in South America. I mean, I think, where do you start with this? Put plainly, the whole thing is incredibly transparent because they want the 2034 World Cup to be in Saudi Arabia. You know, there was a lot of, you know, again, England were reportedly interested in the bid for 2030, or I guess it would have been a part of a UK bid that is now going to be the European Championships in 2028. But it was decided not to put their efforts towards it because it became apparent that FIFA had wider ambitions for 2030. Yeah, the suggestion was that perhaps it would go to South America, and again, acknowledging that centenary, but what we've got now is we don't really have a centenary tournament in South America. We have a European World Cup with Morocco also co-hosting. I don't think that's necessarily egregious given the proximity of those three countries. You know, Morocco has bid for this tournament a lot of times. So that I don't really have too much of an issue with that, in that I think it's kind of inescapable. If you want a World Cup, there is going to be some sort of traveling involved and environmental impact. That is what it is. But it's going to be spread out over, you know, how many countries. It's going to be a bigger tournament as well. It's going to be the new format that we're seeing in 2026. And of course, by including those countries from three different confederations, it paves the way as part of their continental rotation policy for Saudi Arabia to host in 2034. Of course, they're not the confirmed hosts, but the other thing snuck out this week was that the deadline for submissions for bidding was in 4 weeks' time.
Yeah. At which point the Saudis announced that they were formally entering. And then about an hour later, I think the head of the AFC said that the Saudi bid had all of their support. So I think we can probably assume we know where that's going. There was some talk, I think, of Australia maybe teaming up with New Zealand to host, as they have just done with the Women's World Cup. That would be the first time that the World Cup had ever gone to that part of the world. But it looks very much like this was a backroom done deal to make sure that not only were all of the members of the South American Confederation pretty happy, they got their World Cup matches, they got their World Cup ceremonies, but also FIFA continued to woo the Saudis and their deep pockets.
I was going to say, like, as well as sort of the bidding process sort of being shortened, it also came out that FIFA usually want you to have 7 stadiums existing ready to go as part of your sort of proposed bid. They've now narrowed that down from 7 to 4. And conveniently in Saudi Arabia, there are 4 stadiums that fit FIFA's criteria of being over 40,000. So yeah, it feels as though they selectively really got that number spot on regarding a Saudi bid.
4 stadiums for how many teams?
I mean, who knows what it'll be by 2034, but I think it's 48 teams. I mean, the one thing I'll say is, you know, again, I think we've talked about this on the podcast before. This is a little bit different from Qatar in that Saudi Arabia does have a football heritage. Even before the influx of money in Saudi Pro League, it was fairly well-established domestic competition, and the national team is well-supported. There is a football culture there. So it is a little bit different from Qatar, and I think we should make that distinction. I don't think anyone's saying that fans of Saudi Arabia shouldn't have the World Cup, but I think the complete lack of a normal bidding process. I think Australia and New Zealand would host an amazing men's World Cup. I think they've proved that with the women's tournament and everything else they've hosted. They were very unlucky not to be treated more seriously for the 2022 bidding. The whole thing has just appeared to be construed so FIFA can have the tournament that it wants.
Yeah, the backdrop of this, I guess, as well, is that FIFA needs money for its expanded Club World Cup, which I'm sure the Saudis will be probably slightly more happier to provide now that they are safe in the knowledge that they will be able to continue their sports washing efforts deep into the next decade.
The interesting thing is, from a pure cost point of view, I do wonder if the World Cup is actually the best thing for Saudi Arabia to have. It's going to cost a lot of money to host the World Cup, whereas transfer fees for players are actually cheaper and create more prolonged publicity. But again, Saudi Arabia says it wants to increase its GDP through sport. It also wants to provide sporting events for its quite young population. And it's got other reasons for doing it.
No, for sure. And like in all of this as well, we can harp on about sports washing. We can harp on about sustainability and all this kind of stuff. This is like a genuine attempt from the Saudis to change the mix of their national economy. That shouldn't be overlooked. That said, their national economy is currently one of the biggest like damages to the environment on the planet, if not the biggest. I'm not sure what a World Cup where you're asking fans to fly from South America to Africa and Southern Europe and then taking it to the country that is one of the biggest oil producers in the world says about FIFA's trying to achieve sustainability goals. Like, it just sends out totally the wrong message, not to mention as well all the human rights issues that are regularly highlighted when it comes to Saudi Arabia too. Just from a kind of FIFA overall perspective, the idea that this regime had moved on from the grubby days of Sepp Blatter, where we're having tournaments in Qatar and Russia back to back, now really feels like they've kind of gone through the looking glass and they are beyond. There's no difference. It's just a different change. It's a change of leader with slightly different priorities, but all in all, we're back again to an organization running the world's most popular sport in the interest of a very few amount of people.
I'm not a FIFA apologist, but this is a trend in terms of, I guess, unilateral decisions of tournament hosts is something that's becoming a bit more common because of the cost and resources needed to host them. Again, you know, the IOC works with Olympic hosts rather than having an open bidding process. There is an element of that, but it just appears as though any pretense has now been abandoned. I mean, at least all the faults of that 2018, 2022 joint awarding process, you know, it did go to a vote, and I know they've changed the process slightly. So it just appears as though there's just been a complete shift in thinking of FIFA.
All right. Stephen Caswell, I'm aware that you have to run off to an urgent meeting. Thank you very much for joining us this week, and we look forward to having you back on again very soon.
Thank you for having me.
Our final subject on this week's pod, it's a kind of new-ish trend, although I guess nothing is particularly new in sponsorship because ultimately it's just people buying things from each other. It was recently announced that the world's most subscribed YouTuber, I believe, Mr. Beast, his snack brand, Feastables, has become the new jersey patch partner for the Charlotte Hornets. That's probably a multi-million dollar deal. And it kind of continues something that we've seen more in European football, actually, with Prime, the energy drink that was launched by similarly famous YouTubers KSI and Logan Paul. Sponsorship deals are sponsorship deals. There's only so much you can say about them. But it's interesting that, to me at least, that these are coming from slightly different sectors and that you've got these new players in the market. And actually, the structure of those deals and what they bring, there's kind of an interesting appeal for both sides, right?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. I think in terms of, from the, I guess, team's perspective, you're targeting a younger audience in a way in which, I guess, you wouldn't be able to without having this influencer on your side. And having that exposure as well and being able to use that influencer and marketing campaigns as well, that obviously brings a lot of value. And then on the flip side for these influencers, I listen to how YouTube doesn't pay much or ad revenue or these sort of complaints or this platform doesn't sort of provide a stable income for me. And so being able to diversify, first of all, by creating these sort of companies and brands, but then also then inking these sponsorship deals to sort of ensure that sort of alternative revenue stream is stable and goes up is a pretty, it's a good way for them to do so. And yeah, you see how vastly popular the Prime drinks brand is. I've no doubt that sort of its tie-ins with sports teams has sort of helped. And yeah, again, it provides these influencers an alternative revenue stream and these sponsorship deals sort of help bolster those and keep those sort of revenue streams afloat.
Yeah, in a funny way, I mean, there's multi phases to the influencer life, but in a funny way, being an influencer has many parallels with being an athlete. You have a window of time in which to make some money. You might be able to make quite a lot of money, but at some point that will probably stop. You don't hear of so many like influencers reaching careers of, that might not be the case in 20, 30 years. We might be talking about KSI launching a Zimmer frame brand, but I somewhat doubt it. So yeah, cashing in while you get the chance, I think is a really big play on this. Prime is a bizarre phenomenon, I think, to me as a social media thing. I mean, I think there was a point where bottles of Prime were selling in shops in the UK for upwards of £100, which is crazy. But kind of legitimizing it and bringing it into the wider consciousness by doing deals with Arsenal and Bayern Munich and Barcelona and UFC. You're right. It solidifies that brand. It takes them outside of the sphere of just their following on their different social platforms, mostly YouTube, maybe into the realms where people have got a bit more spending power, adults generally. And I guess as well for teams, it's an interesting one. I'm sure no marketing deal with these kind of brands is going to be signed off without some level of input from those influencers, or access to those influencers and collaboration with those influencers on their channels in order for the teams to grow their brands on those platforms, which, let's face it, like sports sometimes struggles to reach.
Yeah. And with these sort of influencers, I know, you know, subscriber numbers don't really tell a full story, right? Because you can obviously watch a video without subscribing to it. But I guess it gives these teams a fixed number at which they know who they're bringing into their audience. Companies, I guess, when they sort of sign these marketing deals, they'll say their audience, but we don't know necessarily who that is or how many people that is or what demographic that is. With these influencers, I guess it gives you sort of those details in a more specific way. So I think for sports teams, it's a big win. And going back to sort of what the influencers have, I guess, you know, KSI, Logan Paul, we've seen them embroiled in controversy, and we've seen sort of revenue deals and sponsorship deals sort of stripped away very quickly. So the stability of sort of getting a sponsorship deal with a sports team, and unlike, I guess, sort of the deals with the various crypto brands, I guess there's a lot more stability for these sports teams to sort of get these deals with these creators, knowing that, you know, it's hard to avoid and see how much they make on the internet, right? Those sort of net worths and sort of how much they make for a video, whatever, those numbers are all over. So it's very, it's a much more of a known quantity for teams. And I guess, you know, it feels like there's a lot less downside, I guess, than, you know, going for maybe more safer sort of option in terms of these deals.
Yeah. The only thing that you'd maybe point to and look at is some of that brand safety, stuff, right? Like Logan Paul and KSI. I mean, KSI is maybe slightly more vanilla than Logan Paul, but Logan Paul has the potential to, at any point, to do something completely crazy, which you maybe don't want your brand associated with. And look, you don't know whether or not that will kind of have pushback on Prime. Mr. Beast is fairly safe, fairly PG, but at any point, maybe that's the slight risk here. But at this point, it is a slight risk. And in a market where new brand deals aren't always the most forthcoming, we've lost the crypto brands. Betting brands could be on their way out. Maybe this is a sector that sports teams can look to go in. I think that's probably the best place for us to leave it with this week's pod. I hope everyone's enjoyed listening. And we also hope that George will be back behind the mic very soon. Wish him a speedy recovery. Josh Sim, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.